Right, thanks for inviting me. And this story is about Burgers' equation with Poissonian noise. And I'm sure that many of you know all about Burgers' equation, but I still I will begin with basics anyway. So the Burgers' equation is a partial differential equation that looks like this. And first I'm considering it without viscosity and without noise, and so I'm putting zero on the right-hand side. So u is a function of time and space, and it plays the role of the velocity field. So this equation describes the evolution of a velocity field, and this is a velocity field of free non-interacting particles. And so what's written on the left-hand side is the complete derivative of a particle, and so it says that the derivative is zero. So what it means is the following. So you have at time zero, you have this initial profile. So suppose this is x, and this is your initial velocity u. And so far there is no randomness. Randomness will appear a long time later. And so suppose at initial time you have just some velocity profile, and so you have particles that move to the right slowly, and you have particles that move to the right faster. And so as time goes on, of course, the particles on the left, if they move faster, then they will eventually take over the particles that are on the right. And then what I'm drawing here is the profiles of the solution at later times. But eventually, at some point, there will be this event when the particles behind will take over the particles in front, and then the solution is not uniquely defined, because at each point you will have several candidates for the solution. But there is a physical way to choose one of them. And then you end up with solution that has this downward jump, and then you have the shock wave. So the velocity on the left is not equal to the velocity on the right, and this wave actually propagates, well, in this situation to the right, and there is a very precise way of describing this. So this equation is sort of archetypical system where you have shock waves and you have evolution of shock waves. Another way of looking at this is considering the actual trajectories of particles. So if this is a picture in space-time, then the trajectories of the particles in the space-time, they're straight lines, right? Because if the velocity is constant, so each particle moves like this, right? It's with constant velocity, and then you will see that these trajectories will merge. If the velocity on the left is greater than the velocity on the right, and then you can write down the equation for the evolution of the position of the shock, and the equation is called the Rankine-Fugonio condition, and it looks like this. So you have just to take the arithmetic average between the velocities on the right and on the left. And so you can see this as particles merging into the shock from the left and to the right. And so the shock absorbs new particles, and when I said that there is a physical way of defining the system, it basically means that there is a momentum conservation here that goes on. And this determines the evolution of the shock. So you can also, if you want, just to summarize the evolution of this in two words, then you can say that this is the evolution of sticky dust. So these particles, they don't interact, but they form clumps, and so when they come together, they merge, and then these clumps of particles, they evolve. Now, if there is a forcing on the right hand side, so the forcing also depends on space and time. Then what you end up with is, of course, not straight lines, but some curved trajectories, and then you have, again, you can have multiple shocks forming here and there, and then these shocks evolve somehow, and they can only merge; they cannot disappear. And what's an interesting problem is to understand the ergodic properties of these systems when the right hand side is random. So the basic tool for studying the system, the systems with, well, I mean, this equation, the system of particles, when the right-hand side is non-trivial, is the so-called Lux-Alenik variational principle. And it says the following. So if you want to find the solution of your system at time t and at a point x, and what you're given is the initial velocity profile, then you're supposed to do the following. You must consider. First, you must consider the potential of the initial velocity field. So we just did the space derivative, right? So the initial condition, you just take the antiderivative of it, and you get the potential. And then you can use this potential to write down an explicit expression for the solution. So it's a lengthy formula, but let me write it down anyway. Okay, so first, let me explain what this means. F is the antiderivative, is the potential of the force. So the derivative of this capital F with respect to space is equal to F to the small f of t index. Now what is now u was defined. U zero was defined here, and you must consider all possible curves that connect this point tx to the line t equals zero. So you must consider all possible curves gamma that are absolutely continuous, so that the derivative is well defined, and then you must take the curve that minimizes this expression, and if there is one curve like that, then there are two ways to understand what the solution is given this. One way is just to differentiate this u with respect to x, and this will be precisely u x. And the other way is just to compute this, just to see what the slope of this curve is at the end point. And then it turns out that actually this curve can be identified with the trajectory of the particle. So if you want to understand what the velocity is, you must what the velocity of is at this point x at time t. You must solve this variational problem, and then automatically you get this curve, and so you also identify the particle that ends up there. Now there are situations where this curve is not unique, and so you can have two curves like that, and then this corresponds to a situation where you have shock, so that there are two different particles that come to the same position from two different locations, and they each bring their velocities, and so in the end, what you have is the following: you solve this variational problem for all possible t and x, and then the whole space is sort of foliated by this minimizing trajectories, and you can understand these trajectories as the trajectories of particles. So you can track all these particles and see how they interact with each other. Just by solving this this variational problem. So now I should introduce some randomness, right? So far I described what happens if, well, I just told you given F, given the right-hand side, the forcing, well, actually the acceleration field, right? So it tells you that this is the acceleration, the left-hand side computes the acceleration, and this is what the acceleration, and you prescribe the acceleration by this function F. So now it is interesting to study the system with random right-hand side. And I'm mostly interested in the ergodic properties of this system. And the first paper, actually a couple of papers, that was written by Weininger, Hanin, Mazel, and Sinai, and this is late 90s. And so what they did was the following: they considered these dynamics on the circle, and for me it is more usual to denote the circle as T1 because this is a one-dimensional torus. And so they essentially considered a periodic situation, and the forcing that they considered was a linear combination of several white noises in time. So they had a situation where there are several sources of randomness, each one being a white noise, and but the functions f that are here in front of white noise, they were smooth in space, and so given this kind of, well, I don't want to talk about any technical conditions on this, but let me just say that this is just a theoretic case, so that at any time this is supposed to be equal to the shifted force in space is equal to itself, and under this kind of forcing, you what you get is that the integral of the velocity field stays constant, and if you restrict this, if you want to study ergodic properties, then you have to restrict yourself to one of ergodic, well, to one of potential ergodic components, and you can, for example, restrict yourself to the situation where the integral of the average velocity is equal to zero. And then what they managed to prove is, first of all, they made sense of this variational principle for this kind of noise, and they proved unique ergodicity, the existence and uniqueness of invariant measures, and they actually proved more. They proved so-called one force, one solution principle, and that's what I want to discuss now. So what they had is the following situation. So you are on the circle, and this is the circle, and it is multiplied by the time axis. So you have this cylinder. And if you want to find the solution at this point, so this is point Gx, but now x is a point on the circle. Suppose you start with, say, zero initial condition, so that the initial velocity profile is identical to zero, and particles are not moving. And then you have to solve that variational problem given, well, for this kind of noise. And what you end up with some trajectory here. And this is the trajectory of the particle that arrives to this point. But then this initial time, let's say that it was at time minus t, where t is large. And then what you do is, of course, you let this time capital T go to minus infinity, and for each time very far away in the past, you solve the same problem. And well, in principle, of course, every time you might end up with a different trajectory here. But the point that they were able, the theorem that they were able to prove is that actually these trajectories they stabilize in a sense that the slope of these minimizing trajectories, they stabilize at the terminal point. And this happens for almost every realization of the noise. So for every realization for every omega, for every realization of the noise, you can do this procedure. So you recover the solution at any given time by the realization of the noise in the past. Yes. Yeah, they well, they have some technical assumption which actually makes it possible for particles to travel around. Well, of course, you can prove it everywhere. It's just what's essential is here because I want to. It does. Well, I mean, there's no whole interval. I mean, you take longer time periods, and if you fix a finite box, finite interval, then on that interval that it stabilizes, surely. Yeah.
That's stronger than saying it's a derivative.
That's true, but that's equivalent in fact. I mean, these trajectories, they are just solutions of earlier Lagrange equations, and if the initial conditions here, if they one converges to the other, then the whole curve converges, of course. And so what they did here, in a sense, what I'm describing here, is that the solution at any time t and at any point x is a functional of the realization of the noise in the past. Up to time t, and this is called one-fourth solution. Well, I just told you that you must start with zero initial condition, but the actual theorem that they could prove was that if you start from a broad class of initial condition that with zero average, then anyway this works. So there is certain contraction in the system, and so it doesn't matter. Well, basically for I mean, which initial condition you take back to minus infinity, and you then, if you do this sort of pullback procedure, then you recover this unique solution. And so this is called one-fourth one solution principle. And this technique basically, it was improved in papers by Hanin and Turiaga, similar situations were considered in multiple dimensions on multiple dimensional torus, and for solutions with positive viscosity. And moreover, the invariant measures for viscosity for solutions with positive viscosity, they actually converge to the invariant measure for the equation with zero viscosity. The point that I want to make here is that all this is done usually for a compact domain. So it is really essential that you have a torus here. And so, in a sense, that there's not much freedom in here. So the solution cannot really escape much. And variational problems, of course, are easier on compact domains. And as far as non-compact domains are considered, so there is a paper by Kostya and Huang that's maybe 2004 or something like that, where they do consider this problem on an unbounded domain, and they prove several interesting things in this spirit, but it. For a special kind of potential, and they don't characterize completely the domain of attraction, right? So here I told you that for various initial conditions this procedure works. So here I want to introduce a model in a non-compact setting. Which leads to essentially the same kind of results, and the model that I want to consider is based on Poissonian point process, and the reason why I'm doing this is, it's hard to work with this, and I want just to simplify my life, and I want something that is easier to visualize and think about, and you will see that I'll try to draw some pictures, and you will see that some of these pictures look promising. I mean, you can easily think about this process. So let me try to to formalize it. So in the new model that I'm proposing, the forcing, the right hand side, well, actually, what is supposed to play the role of the potential of the forcing, it is given by the negative sum of delta functions assigned to Poissonian points. Why am I doing this? It's because I want that the term. I mean, let's look at this equation. So that variation of principle. So what it amounts to is you find the optimal path through this random landscape, and so you accumulate randomness on your way from various locations in space time. So I hope that it doesn't really matter if I simplify the landscape, and I'm considering just the landscape which consists of this Poissonian points scattered around, and I hope that there is, I mean, the difference. Well, some features of the solutions will be more or less the same. Of course, there will be some artifacts, and I will of course describe what they are, what's going to be different for these specific solutions. So this is the Poissonian process with the following intensity. I assume that there is some measure in the x direction times the Lebesgue measure in the time direction. So it is homogeneous in time. I want my process to be a true cocycle, a random dynamical process with stationary increments. And that's why this is Lebesgue measure. And this is some measure, and I will require it. For the purpose of this, of all these theorems, I must require that this measure has a finite first moment. So it is a restrictive condition. Of course, it means that there will be. I mean, I'm imposing some kind of localization by doing this. But this localization is not very hardcore. I mean, so it means that these Poissonian points will appear no matter how far. I mean, you will see them, but of course, far away from the origin, they will appear not as often as in the middle. So I wanted to say that this is supposed to be finite. Okay, and then I can rewrite. I want to consider that. I want to replace this term with the following. So here you have just the number of points that this path gamma passes through. So I will just say the number of Poissonian points in gamma. And so now if we look at this, I mean, this certainly reminds us about Hammersley's process. And the idea is that if you want to minimize this, of course you want to go through as many Poissonian points as you can, but there is the term that doesn't allow you to do this completely efficiently is this term, because you are not allowed to deviate too much. And so what you have is then this kind of landscape. You have this point scattered around, and then if you want to find a solution here. Then you try to collect all of them, all these points, but maybe this trajectory is not very good because this slope is horribly high, and so it contributes a lot to this, and so there must be some balance between these two, and it is this balance that's going to lead to some localization. Now, of course, I mentioned Hammersley process here, and I mean, it is known that it's connected to the Burgess equation. It's not big news. I mean, say Timo's work it explicitly uses Hammersley's process for convergence of particle system to the Burgess equation. So let's just understand what this picture is. So what is the effect of introducing, say, one point? So suppose you have a flow of particles that are moving, say, in this direction, and then they encounter one one Poissonian point. So what's the effect of this on the velocity field? So how is going to how the influence of this particle is going to propagate? And so if you have a point here, then if you look at that variational principle, there are basically two ways you could possibly proceed. You could one way is you can arrive to a particle that just was following its original trajectory could arrive here. And another situation is that this new particle, I mean, if you're greedy about Poissonian particles, then maybe you also want to catch this one and find the optimal, maybe the optimal path is the one that passes through this point. And then, of course, there would be certain curve here that would separate these two behaviors from each other. So on this side of the curve, you will have the original velocity and as if this point was not there at all. And inside, you will have all these points connected to this one by straight lines. Because in the absence of, if there is no forcing here inside, then you're basically solving the forceless Burgers equation. Then all the trajectories are straight lines. And so what you see here is that if a flow of these particles, if it encounters in this model this point source, then it looks as if at this point you introduce this fan of particles, which is particles moving in both directions with all possible velocities. And of course, this shock, it evolves according to just the usual Rankine-Fugonio conditions, and here locally it behaves as a parabola. You can do a very explicit computation here. Now, how it behaves further on, it depends on the incoming velocity field, of course. And of course, at some point you will meet another point here, and it will produce its own domain of influence like this, and then you will meet another one maybe. And so you will end up with a tessellation of this space into these cells, and it sort of looks like fish scales. And so each particle has its own sort of domain of influence. So all the motion in this cell is dominated by the particles emitted from this point source. Now, if you look at the velocity profile, then you will see this. Suppose you're looking here, right? So this is time, this is space. So this is time equals zero, and zero means here. This is without loss of generality, so time is equal to zero. And then you see nothing. Just the incoming velocity profile. And suppose it's constant, so it looks like this. But then as time goes on, you will see that this thing appears. And then you will see a situation like this, right? So you will, this part is linear. The outside is whatever prescribed by the incoming flow of particles. And as time goes on, this interval it grows, right? Because it's parabola. Until it meets some other parabola, or whatever that curve actually is. But the slope declines, right? Because as you move further away, then the gradient of this is it's related to the length of this. And so as time goes on, this becomes broader. But not as steep as the initial one. And at time zero, you will have sort of infinite slope here, but of zero size though. So the point here is that this dynamics just leads to nice pictures that you can think about. And so optimal paths they all pass through this. Through this Poissonian point, and you have this random tessellation, and a typical solution is then so you have these multiple parabolas or maybe perturbed parabolas, And the typical solution, it looks like this. So it is, so while you are inside the parabola, then you have this linear function, and then you have a downward jump, and that's when you cross the parabola, and then you're automatically in the domain of another one. So at each time you will see this piecewise linear velocity, and as time goes on, what goes on is that the slopes they decline, and there is some interaction, some of the boundaries move around with actually prescribed velocities. So for this system, I can prove basically the same that I tried to explain to you about the original paper of these four authors. So suppose you have this condition, and then for almost every realization of the forcing, there is a unique way to restore the velocity at any point tx, and that way you must consider the minimizers for this problem at longer and longer time scales. So it looks like this. You want to find the solution at point tx, and you are given the realization of the Poissonian field in the past. And well, most of these points are in the middle, but they're scattered all over the plane. And you start at any time in the past, and you find the minimizer. And so it is some trajectory that is a broken line between the Poissonian points, and well, and it has some slope here. If you start at a time that's even earlier than this, you might get a different broken line, but the statement, well, the theorem is that as this time t goes to infinity, as the length of this time interval goes to infinity, then these broken lines they stabilize, and they stabilize in a stronger sense than in that example. And that's the advantage of this model, because it's just at some point they will literally coincide. I mean, they might be different further away. For different times, but there will be an interval where close to this time t, where they will literally coincide, and so this means that the theorem that I can formulate is the following. So for almost every omega, which is just the realization of the Poissonian forcing, there is a global solution U. It depends on omega, and this solution U, it can be obtained by this procedure if you start with zero initial conditions, and not only zero initial conditions. And I will at least try to explain what the initial conditions are, what the domain of attraction is. So the point is that this solution is unique. This solution, this global solution, is unique. And it is attracting. And it is unique and attracting in a certain class. And I will try to describe this class. So I already explained to you how how approximately it goes, right? So you try to initiate your solution at early and early times, and you see what happens at time, say time zero. But why does it really work? So the main localization lemma is the following. So for every time t, there is, so this is time t, there is a random variable r with index t, and it depends on omega, that I will call the radius of localization. And then the statement is that for any r, for any capital R, if you consider, you may want to consider these, well, all possible minimizers, all possible trajectories that connect this segment from minus R to R, to points of this segment to points of this segment. And I want to state that this situation is impossible. So that all these minimizers they have to pass through this interval of that I call the interval of localization, because I don't so all the minimizers they are localized within this interval. But of course this happens only if the time is the time interval between these two is sufficiently large. So time should be at least it's random time, and it depends on this r, and it also depends on this t, in fact, and these two times they don't necessarily have to coincide in both directions. So if you make a long step back in time and step forward in time, then you're guaranteed that these minimizers among all possible connecting any point here to any point here, that will necessarily come through this interval. And why is it true? Well, it's because when you are away from zero, you don't accumulate a lot of Poissonian points basically. And there is a way to invoke the law of large numbers that says that it's. I mean, on average, of course, there are much more points here, and so it is more profitable for the path. To go through a huge cloud of Poissonian points rather than wander away very far from the infinity. And these times, they're just connected to the sort of time. So it's the first time when the law of large numbers starts doing its job, basically. And so you end up with this picture. For each time, you have a certain localization radius, and so you have this stationary process of these localization intervals, and you know that all minimizers they must go through these gates, and so this is an essential compactification of the problem, and then you just have to make sure that you erase some of them so that you make these times between them match these times the times of this interval. And then you have to understand that for every 2 points here and every 2 points there, the path there is a chance that this path will coincide at least will share a point somewhere inside. And this is actually a standard technique in all this business. And you know, people call it the focusing event or a narrow place. So, and as soon as you manage to find such an event, then if you are looking for a minimizer here, then and you know that somewhere these two minimizers they share a point, then of course from this point on, only one minimizer is possible, and so they just have to coincide. And so if you find this focusing event, I have little control on when it can happen, unfortunately. But you can identify it, and you can make it work. So this basically explains how the contraction works. So you start back from the past, and then you go forward, and due to these focusing events, everything just works. Now, the next issue is to identify the Well, first I'm going to say just one word about how this solution, what does it look like? So I already told you that it looks like a sequence of slope segments. But also another important feature is that this thing stabilizes at plus infinity and minus infinity. So there is a certain level A, and at the same level minus A. So this is the zero level. This is level A. This is minus A. And theorem that for almost every omega at time zero or at any given time with probability one, these segments. The solution approaches these two levels, a and minus a, as x approaches infinity. Now, how can you see this? You can imagine the following situation. Imagine for a second that all these Poissonian points, they're localized in a certain small narrow strip, well, a strip of finite length, and then you want to understand what happens very far from this strip. X goes to infinity. And then it's clear that the minimizer should come, you know, from one of these Poissonian points, and then all you care about is the slope of this thing. And how do you choose the slope? Well, you denote this. Well, this is x. Well, let's say that this is zero and there is some finite width on the left. And this time is t. And this time is, say, capital T, so that the remaining part is capital T minus small t, the length of this. And then the action that this path accumulates here is, you can write it as x squared over 2t. Well, this is just the, well, I erased it, I guess. This is just the action of this path when there are no points here. No Poissonian points accumulated by this path, and this is what it accumulates. And then another contribution is the action that accumulates here, and it accumulates with a random rate. But you can use subadditivity to say that there is a certain constant a, well, actually minus a, because it's going to be negative, and approximately you accumulate this. So the length of this time interval times this constant a, which is not non-random. And so then you differentiate this with respect to t, and then you get just the optimal slope. And the optimal slope turns out, this optimal slope turns out to be square root of 2 capital A. And so this calculation, it tells you what it's going to be if there is just finite, if there is a strip of finite width. And of course in reality in this problem you don't have a strip of finite width. Of course you have points everywhere, but then you have to consider this problem. So you have a point x there, and you must show that if you draw the slope of a here, and if you go a little bit above, and that's the slope a plus epsilon, this is slope a minus epsilon, then you must choose this radius r to be sufficiently large so that the constant in the subadditivity theorem would approximate the constant for the whole real line. And then you must consider the paths. You must prove that there are no paths that behave like this. There are no paths that behave like this. There are no paths that behave like this and like that. So basically, all the paths that they must go through this cone. And you can do it using various properties of. Well, basically, it's always based on the law of large numbers or subadditive. Results. I mean, you just accumulate points here or there with certain rays, and that's what it is. So so now the one final statement is this. So we know that we know that on average, this compact part, it emits particles with this asymptotically with the velocity A. And now, what are the solutions that are attracted by this special solution that I announced in the beginning? These are solutions that emit particles. These are initial conditions that emit particles from minus infinity back into the compact domain with not too high velocity. So yeah, right. So if this velocity is very high, then of course this wave will overcome the flow of particles emitted by the central part. But if this velocity is not, if this asymptotic velocity at infinity is less than A with the opposite sign, then you will see that this solution basically expands, and you will get the perfect match of your solution and this of my special solution and this solution. In any finite box, there will be time after which they will just coincide. That's all.